change your heart. Look around you.
Well, welcome to Wherever You Are. I'm Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you are listening to episode 83 of the Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. Today's guest has a dubious honor bestowed upon him.
Dubious indeed.
Wait for it. Today's guest is technically a fourth-time guest, but all three of your previous appearances are archived. So,
yeah, I know.
So technically you're
blow
back.
Blow me out of the water, man. I don't exist.
I'm very sorry about that. So this is my way of making amends. You're kind of the anti-Matthew Brown.
I'll take that.
Okay, so we welcome him, you know, again, but really, you know, for the first time. Yes, exactly. He is the brains behind Eternal Sunshine of the Logical Mind, a site you can find at Eternal Sunshine of the Logical Mind, .blogspot.com. Are you worried that Blogspot's going to go tits up, by the way?
I should do something about that at some point.
It was one of those things that I was, when Reader,
yeah.
You know, just had to
finally migrated
in
off
July.
That.
It's one of those things everybody's wondering, is Blogger going to be next?
Not worried about it, but I should really get myself a domain name.
It never hurts. Bob Turnbull.
Hey!
welcome back. You were actually, I think, the other thing, when I listened to the other show, I think you were the first guest here in this place.
Like, oh, really?
Because we'd been here for about 6 months or so before the Source Code episode, but I think all of those episodes
were Skype.
Yeah, so yeah.
Another honor bestowed upon
history
me.
Abounds.
This is awesome.
Well, on episode 83, we'll be discussing Upstream Color. We'll be finding out people's favorite documentaries and turn the record over to play the other side. Before that, there is a little bit of housekeeping before we get to know more about Bob. The site and the podcast will be turning its attention to hot docs beginning this week. Are you going?
Oh, yeah.
Well, so there we go. Bob and I are both doing hot docs. Hot docs is North America's largest documentary film festival. It's happening April 25th to May the 5th here in Toronto, Canada. And I play Man About Town during the film festival. So during the next 10 days or so, there's going to be lots of reviews on the great nonfiction that the festival's bringing in. So that's all happening on the site beginning April 24th. In amongst there will also be a few podcasts where I talk with filmmakers and filmgoers over the next week. So there are Matinee Cast offshoot I call Life in Technicolor. Bob was on one back in the day. And they will start dropping hard and fast next week. I hope to get at least three of them in. There might be four. Who knows? So check out the festival website, hotdocs.ca. Watch matinee.ca for a lot of nonfiction coverage. Please stick with it. I know that a lot of times my readership kind of takes a dive in this particular week.
But it is kind of a shame because I think the last 3 or 4 years, one of the films I've seen on Hot Docs, maybe even two, have made my top 10. Last year,
yeah.
I had two in the top 11, I think.
Yeah, it's just
a fantastic fest.
It's a double whammy of we're talking about films that nobody's seen yet, and we're talking about films that are nonfiction that have a smaller audience. But I promise you, this stuff, when it goes on to be available on Netflix and in theaters, you'll want to see it. So watch a matinee, and I won't steer you wrong. Now, though, it is time to learn more about Bob. This is Know Your Enemy. So, like I say, three-time guest.
There's only one way off the stage, Ryan.
Yeah, no kidding. There's only one way off this podcast. Way back during the first days of Matinee Cast, we learned that one of the first films Bob saw was Sleeping Beauty, the Disney classic. The last film he'd seen at the time was Fine, Totally Fine. The worst film he'd ever seen was Shark Attack 3, Megalodon. Does that still hold?
It's in the top five, I'd say, at least.
The unseen classic or essential was The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Have you heard?
Now seen, absolutely.
Very nice.
It's excellent.
The film that he wished he had made, there was a double dose. First, of course, was The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, for reasons that should be obvious, and Airplane, just because it's so darn fun. The second time out, we learned that the film Bob likes and nobody else does was Ocean's 12, which I do like. We talked about that at the time.
I think there was a wider audience than I gave it credit for.
I don't think there is.
I'm hopeful that there
is. I know. The film that everybody else liked that he did not was True Romance. Did you ever revisit that?
I did, and I certainly like it more than I did at the time,
but
it's
not,
still not a movie that I will likely gravitate to on a regular basis.
Gotcha. In the movie of Bob's life, Anthony Edwards plays him. The film he was watching next was The Outlaw Josie Wales. How'd that work out for him?
Are you kidding? Of course.
I've seen it.
That's excellent.
So, round three. Robert, what is the film that made your love for film turn a corner?
That is an excellent question. I think I've answered a couple of times with a few people. The first one that jumps to mind for me is Raising Arizona by the Coen brothers. Mainly because at the time I saw it, I was dating myself slightly here, probably about 18 or so in the theater. With a bunch of friends, and we're all expecting big comedy kind of a thing. They left kind of, the hell was that? I was okay. I was completely turned around. I was like, oh my God, you can do that in a movie? You can make the camera do that? You can have people act that way? I was blown away, and to this day, it's still one of my favorite films. Even with Nicolas Cage being Nicolas Cage, it was at the time when that was kind of cool, and it made sense in the film.
You know, I was a little bit late to the party to that. I didn't see that one until a year or two ago.
Oh, okay.
I was late to the party with the Coens. There were a right. filmmaking duo that I was not crazy about when I first came into them, and I still submit that there is an order that you have to take their films. Otherwise, it's just not quite going to make...
Potentially. I mean, I've seen them mostly in order for the most part. Blood Simple being the first one I saw. And then
well, like, I was going to say, you kind of came along with them. I didn't.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit younger than you. And I, along with not seeing stuff like, heck, even just like Hudsucker Proxy when it came out or Miller's Crossing or you know, I came to them at Fargo, which I didn't understand the concept of black comedy and so on. But no, I could certainly see why, you know, seeing, hey, film can do this after...
compared to what I'd seen at that point, for sure, anyway.
What was that, 86?
80, almost 85.
Yeah, 84, 85, that, yeah, that, think, yeah. yeah, that was yeah. definitely...
Another one, just quickly, was Network, the classic from 76, which, yeah, I adore. I saw that in a media class back in... Well, I grew up in Quebec, so in Cégep, which would have been about grade 12, grade 13. And a professor showed it to us in class, and, you know, in two parts across 2 days, I couldn't wait to get to school the next day to see the rest of that. And I was just like,
awesome.
Yeah, so those are pretty much two that kind of turned me on the path. Like, oh, there's more out there than your standard.
What was your first date movie?
I'll give you two answers on this one, too.
Okay.
E.T. is the first one that I remember really taking a girl to end up being my prom date. We were really just kind of friends, but it was the first time where, you know, after the theater, you know, she's gone to the washroom and you're waiting outside with the row of other men who are waiting for their wives, spouses, you know, girlfriends, whatever. And it's still a film that sort of resonates with me, just even partially due to that reason, because it just brings me right back to, and when I say prom, I mean grade 11, because that's when I graduated high school.
Oh, okay.
The other one would be my first date with Anupa, my wife.
Okay.
A Kiss Before Dying, the remake with Matt Dillon and Sean Young.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did that go? Well you're married, so obviously. You know what? In 83 episodes, that might be the dumbest question I have ever asked, and I'm leaving it in.
So far, so good. It's an ongoing project. It was supposed to be a group outing. A whole bunch of us were going to, like, skip out of work early and go for, like, I think a 3:30 showing. End up just being myself and her notebook. For whatever reason, somebody canceled out. We said, what the hell, we'll go. You know, we're friends. And it wasn't a romantic date, but after that, things started to become more than just friendship. And part of it was because we both looked at the movie in the exact same way, like, oh my God, what is Sean Young doing up on screen? She plays twin sisters, Matt Dillon. Spoil some stuff here, but he kills one of the sisters, and then he starts dating the second one, but the second one's saying, there's something you know, kind of weird about my sister's suicide, and she starts investigating it. She's just awful. She was a double Razzie winner that year for
both
worst
parts.
Actress and worst supporting actress.
That's wonderful. So was that I guess that would kind of be the you know, that thing that kind of brings you together, is coming out of that movie going, oh my God, can you believe that?
And having that sort of, oh, we have a similar sense of humor and appreciation for silliness, and it's kind of carried on from there.
Well, yeah, so. Because if you know, for instance, if you adored it on an absolute level, not in a winking level, or
right.
you know, that kind of thing, she might have looked at you and said, "Oh, this is not this is not good," or vice versa. If she had just not even seen the absurdity in it and just railed on it, you might have thought
possible.
You know,
I think if that had happened, it probably wouldn't have, you know, driven us apart. But this certainly brought us more together.
Yeah. So. Oh, there you go. Good answers for sure. What's your sick day movie?
First one that leapt to mind was Magnolia.
Wow.
Which maybe might be an odd choice for, you know, a 3-hour movie. But for me, that movie flies by in about half the time. And just being about all these different people gaining redemption just strikes me as a good way to pass an entire day where you're sick and you want to get better. And it's I just adore that movie. Much of it is because of its style. I mean, I'm a big fan of just style, even style over substance sometimes.
Right.
And we'll probably get to that a little bit later on. I just adore that movie. I will watch it once a week if I could. I like it that much.
You know what I like about that movie, actually, is that with it being 3 hours, if you're feeling sick, you can drift in and out.
Sure.
You know? Obviously not. Not if you haven't seen it. But if you've seen it, you know, and certainly if you've seen it multiple times, as we both have, you put it on, you can fall asleep, you can nap, you can get your rest, you can come back in, hey, the movie is still going.
You have to savor every moment, Ryan.
I know, but we will, the subject of sleeping through movies is going to come up a few times.
Yes, that's true.
So we'll get there.
But I'd probably follow that up with like an Ocean's 11 or something.
Not Ocean's 12.
Pure. Ah, well, that's obviously the best film of the series,
right,
but Ocean's 11 is just pure entertainment.
Gotcha. Right? What is the last film to leave you speechless?
Again, I can't just give a single answer, so I'm actually going to give you three answers from the last three TIFF festivals.
You're aiming to make this the longest show ever.
Absolutely. Let's see, the last TIFF festival, At Any Price, which I believe Dora mentioned on your last podcast.
She did.
I felt very much the same way as she did. It left me speechless at how bad it was compared to the movies that he had done previously. It was just, we walked out of there, and we were speaking, but we couldn't actually make full sentences because we were just, we couldn't quite finish a sentence to describe how bad this movie really was.
Wow.
And not just from a disappointment point of view, which it was, but just from a, what was he doing? There's a fine message in the movie.
It was speechless from confusion, you were stunned with confusion.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. I mean, there are moments in the movie, I turned to several people. Matt Price was there, our friend Tom from Australia, with jaws dropped and pretty much on the floor, wondering what is going on, what is with that line of dialogue, why is Dennis Quaid acting like that, and on and on. The year before at TIFF, though, I had a much, much better experience with my favorite films of the last 2-3 years, Café de Flore.
Oh, okay.
Which left me a little bit speechless at the end, just because of... It resonated with me for a bunch of personal reasons that I think I mentioned in my review. I don't have to go into right now, but I just walked out feeling both jubilant and very touched at a number of the things it covered. And I know a lot of people see it in a totally different way.
Yeah.
I believe they're completely wrong, because they're missing, I think, what the point of the movie is.
I concur.
But I just adore that movie.
Okay, I'll give you one more.
One last one very quickly was Cold Fish from TIFF 2010 by Sion Sono.
Didn't even hear about this movie.
You will have the jaw on the floor for days and weeks afterwards because of the sheer audacity of that film and the brutal nature and some of the scenes you see that are just like, I can't believe somebody just put that up on screen.
Okay.
It's not for the faint of heart, but it's just an exercise and like, wow. And to this day, it's one of those wow experiences that will stay with
me. So for all sorts of different reasons, I like that actually. Okay. Last but not least, what's the movie quote that would be your epitaph?
So many. I was thinking Monty Python. I wanted to go from Network. But I kind of settled on Raising Arizona, to bring that back, with so many social engagements, so little time. It's the best I could do.
I like that. That's
it doesn't quite sum up my, you know, life's philosophy, but...
Sums up your life, I think. You're a busy guy. I would say for sure, of what I know of you for sure. Well, there we go. I said this before... I think you're the third three-time guest. I've said this twice before. I have no idea what kind of questions I would ask for a fourth time around. but there we go. That's a lot more about Bob. Good answers. I should not be surprised because you always bring the goods. So come on back right after this. We're going to get some feedback from you folks. It's your chance to come talk to me. Why are you shaking like a leaf? Come on, come talk to me. So with Hot Docs upon us, I kept things kind of simple and just asked the listeners what their favorite documentaries were. And do bear with me, because there were a lot of answers, actually. I didn't expect quite so much feedback. Will Malone has once again written a tome, so thank you, Will. Will said, I clearly struggle at brevity, so here's another email. For me, the true sign of a great documentary is when it manages to engage the viewer even when they don't have a particular interest in the subject matter the film is covering. I believe that, by the way. I think a perfect example of this is The Magnificent Senna from 2010. I know a number of people who actively dislike Formula One, but were still captivated by this film. I think it was due in large part to Manish Pandey's script and the decision to show the story rather than tell it. The use of archive footage in the actual races and the off-track politics coupled with the personal footage from the family archive really pulled the viewer in. These clips, which were wonderfully edited together, clearly showed the type of man Senna was, both on and off the track, so there was no need to have a bunch of talking heads explaining it. Throughout the film, there wasn't a single interview, which in my view worked brilliantly and was compelling. A few honorable mentions as well, TT3D Closer to the Edge, the incredible story of bravery on the streets of Isle of Man, Searching for Sugar Man, one of my favorite films of last year, and Restrepo, which shows you the real horror of war. Enjoy Hot Docs, Will. Senna's going to come up a few times, but...
That's a great comment about Senna. I had forgotten that there wasn't actually any, you know, talking head interviews.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think, you know, his final lap, you know what's going to happen for the most part if you know the story. I won't say here, but in the final lap, even if you know what happens, you're so engaged and pulled in. I think it beats everything you've seen before.
Yeah, absolutely. Sean Kelly from SK On Movies said, if you asked me a decade ago if I would be a fan of documentaries, I probably would have laughed. However, I now see them quite regularly, thanks partially to the doc-centered program of the Bloor Cinema. I have to say, my favorite documentary filmmaker is Errol Morris, and his, you're going to have to help me here, Intaraton method of doing interviews?
Right, right. It's basically, it's kind of, it looks like you're speaking right to the camera.
Oh, okay, cool.
And there's kind of, I guess, a reflection or a screen with Errol Morris, so you can speak right to him, but still be looking straight into the camera.
Oh, neat. Undoubtedly, Morris's best work is the Oscar-winning documentary The Fog of War, which has acted as confessional for former U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. I think it's our friend Kurt who said he can't wait for the second Morris one like that when they get Donald Rumsfeld in 20 or 30 years.
Oh, bring it. I would love to see that.
So would I. Nick Hath in Calcutta, India said, I've seen four documentaries in my life and I really enjoyed Exit Through the Gift Shop. I feel like giving her a syllabus. She's given me the Bollywood syllabus, which I do need to go through.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
It's been a crazy few months. I haven't actually gone through it.
I'd love to dive into that, too.
Yeah, and so I think I need to do the reverse for her. Andy Hart from Fandango Groovers in England said, I started watching documentaries in the cinema over the last few years. In the past, I'd only seen them on TV, which I think is kind of how we all get used to them the first time. My favorite in recent years is Senna. There's that one again. I'm a fan of motor racing and consider Ayrton Senna to be the best driver I have ever seen. A testament to how good the movie is, the amount of people who have no interest in the sport that enjoy it. That's me. And of course, right after that from Twitter, our friend Andrew Robinson, G-Man Reviews, said Senna because it made me care about F1 racing. Jess Rogers. Jess is going to be contributing to the matinee during Hot Docs, so she's actually seeing some stuff as well. And she's going to be writing about it, so good. I have to do a little bit less work, and we get to hear what Jess thinks of some of these documentaries. She said Earth Days because it really gives the long view of our environmental movement some clarity. Two steps forward, one step back. Alex Kittle, the film forager, said, in the realms of the unreal, a fascinating and visually creative study of mysterious outsider artist Henry Darger.
No, I haven't seen that, but I've been meaning to catch up with that film. I've heard it's quite good.
In Sweden, Johan Anders said, The Governor, a very obscure black and white Swedish doc that follows the work of a governor of Velvet Cafe Jessica's hometown. The reason I love The Governor is wickedly funny mix of docu-soap feeling and Tarkovsky tempo. Following that, of course, Jessica the Velvet Cafe said, I'm a sucker for docs and really can't point out one favorite. My last 5 out of 5 was Herzog's Grizzly Man. It's gripping and intriguing without being sensational, despite the topic. I kind of feel like I want to revisit that.
I haven't watched that in a couple of years, actually. I thought about it recently because I posted on somebody's review of it about how I didn't actually believe that Herzog actually heard that tape. that tape didn't actually exist.
See, the thing is, because I never know when Herzog is just screwing with us.
That's exactly. Now, granted, that's a difficult thing for him to screw with, but he's, you know, he's that kind of guy.
Yeah, I don't know. So.
I think it's an interesting theory. Anyway.
Yeah, Big Mike Mendez said, Hoop Dreams, it changed my life, even without writing the title on caps, because Hoop Dreams got written on, like, sneakers and caps and whatnot. James Blake Ewing said, Night and Fog, a harrowing document of the Holocaust that asks us to consider the limitations of representation. Courtney, I think, from On the Screen Review in Louisiana, said probably The Cove and Bill Cunningham, New York, both very different, but well put together and engaging. You know, one of the things I like about The Cove that's kind of, we've kind of skimmed over here, is docs sometimes have the ability to take on a genre.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The Cove, of course, is like, it's a heist film.
Is it ever?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's fantastic.
That's one of the things I love about that. Aiden Redmond from Cut the Crap Movie Reviews said, The Thin Blue Line, definitive proof that film can change the world we live in. My friend Louisa gave me a list. She said, Shut Up, Little Man. I haven't seen that. Have you seen that?
I haven't either, no.
You know about it, though?
Yeah, I know about it. It doesn't grab me, but, you know, if somebody's speaking that highly of it, maybe.
Winnebago Man, I love these because watching crotchety old men and finding out what makes them tick. Something called DMT, the spirit molecule. Apparently it blew her mind. One molecule common to all life on Earth and its consciousness. She also mentioned It Might Get Loud, three guitar greats speaking about their influences and jamming together. Fascinating, nostalgic, and frankly, pure guitar sexiness. My friend Beth Beard said, Dear Zachary, a film that I know you adore.
Oh, man. That is a
tragic,
tough,
unbelievable, beautiful.
Tough film to get through.
I still haven't. I still haven't tried.
Dude, I have never wept in a movie before.
Yeah, yeah. Good Hair, interesting and entertaining. I've gone back and watched it multiple times. Waiting for Superman and We Were Here, which played Hot Docs 2 years ago. There's actually a podcast where I talked to the director. Donkey Wrangler to the Stars. I believe his name is actually Aaron. But I apologize if I'm getting your name wrong. But the site is Donkey Wrangler to the Stars. Ken Burns Baseball, the exhaustive research that goes into it. Woodstock, the groundbreaking editing style. Man on Wire, the characterization and use of recreations to build tension. Another film, of course, that plays like a heist movie.
Oh, yeah.
A heist movie marked with, like, mixed with, like, French New Wave, really, you know?
And we know that's a great combination right there.
The Koyaanisqatsi Trilogy, the amazing visuals and score. And next, Daniel Fogarty says, The Decline and Fall of Western Civilization, Part 2, The Metal Years. Does Rush come up in that?
No, they don't. But there's nothing declining about Rush.
My friend
Hall of Fame babe guy.
I know. Yeah, I heard it. Kelvin Mahadio said, The Black Power Mixtape, 1967 to 75. It's like going back in a time machine. Shark Water, very eye-opening about what actually happens in our oceans. And Bret Hart, Wrestling with Shadows, the documentary about the Canadian wrestler getting a look behind the scenes of the wrestling world. Now our friend Courtney Small said, The Imposter, Dear Zachary, The Thin Blue Line, Tabloid, which I still haven't seen, Beauty Day, and The Fog of War.
Oh, Beauty Day's great.
Our friend Kirk Haviland said, The Kid Stays in the Picture, Zog, Dogtown, and Z-Boys, The King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters, Marley, and he includes Pussy Riot, A Punk Prayer, which we haven't even seen yet, so now he's got me stoked for that.
It's already on my list to see, but
yeah. My friend Scott down in Utah said, Style Wars, Freestyle, The Art of Rhyme, Cinemania, which I adore.
Yeah. That's
always
film.
Makes me feel better about myself. And Festival Express. Stevie Taylor in New Zealand said, I don't really watch docs, but I still love Senna for its amazing editing. And Andrew Buckle in Australia said, The Man with a Movie Camera is mine because it captures all elements of a time and place, beautiful voyeurism, and artfully collaborates the immense footage into a dynamic nonfiction experience that has been unmatched for him so far. The best musical accompaniment would have to be the one supplied by Cinematic Orchestra.
He's absolutely right on every single one.
that is a list and a half right there. So thank you everybody for writing in. Now, it's kind of hard to narrow it down to just one. It's like saying, what is your favorite movie? But there's no way you look. There's no way you left it to one.
But if you're going to twist my arm and force me to pick one,
yes.
I'm going to go back to Errol Morris, but okay. I'm going to pick one of his lesser known ones called Mr. Death, The Rise and Fall of Fred A. Luchter Jr. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing
his last name right. I have been meaning to see that forever.
I probably shouldn't say too much more because the first time I saw it, I didn't really know where it went. I knew that he basically designed electric chairs and other instruments of, well, death, basically to put people to death.
I actually do know quite a bit about
okay,
it.
Where it goes.
Yeah.
So the turn really caught me off guard as he basically is searching for validation, any kind of validation. And especially if you've grown up in Toronto or live in Toronto, there's a certain other person who comes into the picture that when that name came up on screen, it just blew me away that he suddenly got involved with this person. And it's a fascinating film. It's also gorgeous, too. All those scenes of kind of lightning and kind of, you know, electrical sparks is just glorious.
I think I'm going to, like, it's been on my to-see list, no short of a lie, for like 10 years.
Catch up if you can. I
think I have.
I should have brought it with me.
I really, I've already still got sympathy for Lady Vengeance over there, so like one thing at a time.
But
what else? You've got more. Of course you have more.
I do have to mention, because I love documentaries about film, A Personal Journey with Martin Scorsese through American Movies is just fantastic. I mean, he gives, there's spoilers abound, but, you know, these are a lot of noir films, you know, mostly films from the 40s, 50s, and 60s, what he grew up with. And it's just amazing. Mainly because it's Martin Scorsese speaking about film. He can speak about anything, and he'll keep me in rapt attention. When he speaks about film, I'm his.
See, that I'll borrow from you, because right now I'm actually reading the book, the Scorsese book by Roger Ebert, where it collects
his
interviews and his...
Definitely get that to you soon.
I'm in a Scorsese frame of mind.
And even with the spoilers, you're still going to want to see pretty much every single film he talks about.
Of course. It's just going to make the to-see list grow and grow.
He's so passionate about it. And, you know, I'm a big fan of noir to start with, so I think I've caught up with so many of those movies that whenever I come back, I was like, oh, yeah, I've seen a few more of those.
Yeah. The first one that comes up when I think about this kind of thing is Capturing the Friedmans.
Oh yeah,
because first of all, it's an example of a documentary that's going to begin about one thing and turns into something altogether different. Because when the filmmakers set out to make it, they thought they were making a documentary about this guy who is a clown, and he comes from a family where, you know, clowning is seen as, you know, as kind of a calling. And there's even a moment that seems completely out of place where, like, he's all dressed up in his clown getup against a white seamless, whereas the rest of the movie is all taken off of camcorders or talking heads. It's this one little bit of graphic that seems so jarring. It's because it started out as something else, beginning. Yeah. So what I love about it is the ultimate fly-on-the-wall documentary, because the Friedmans themselves were so fascinated by cameras and video that they were filming everything. Conversations that had no business being recorded now, in a YouTube age where we record everything, like maybe you could see some of these conversations being captured. Back when these events actually occurred in the late 80s and mid 90s, somebody tossing around a large Sony Handycam is absurd.
What do you think of somebody with that size camera on their shoulder?
Yeah, or even the smaller ones that were, you know, a little bit smaller than a toaster, you'd still think at some point somebody's going to say, turn that thing off. But it keeps rolling. We learn about this family. We learn about their dynamic. We learn about how screwed up they all are, and just how very, very twisted this whole story actually is. And it was, you know, lightning in a bottle that was really, really put together very, very well.
There's a few times where I actually expressed out loud in the theater kind of my feelings, because, you know, you're in a theater.
Yeah.
Watching that film, there was a moment in that movie where I went, oh my God, like out loud. I could not contain myself. And I think it was something one of the police detectives said that just absolutely blew my mind.
Yeah, no, so that is my answer. I don't have a feedback question, just because it's going to be a few weeks before the next episode, so just watch Twitter and Facebook. I'm sure I'll come up with something, and we'll hear from you next time. But for now, we're going to go to the new slang, of a film that's somewhat underseen if you're in a smaller market, but I hope you'll come back and listen to us anyway, because we got some interesting things to say about Upstream Color right after this.
Have you seen the little piggies crawling in the dirt? And for all the little piggies, life is getting worse. Always having dirt.
Upstream Color is written and directed by Shane Carruth. It stars Carruth himself, Amy Simetz, and Andrew Sensenig, among a few other smaller character actors. I'd love to tell you what it's about, but that's going to be a little tricky. Basically, our two leads, Carruth and Simons, they play a couple named, they play two people named Jeff and Chris, both of whom are kind of broken. Chris specifically comes into the film in like a party or a club or something like that. She's out for the night one night and she meets a stranger. The stranger basically dopes her and introduces this weird drug into her system that causes a whole lot of fallout. It may seem like I'm giving away an awful lot of the movie, but the fact of the matter is that I could probably tell the entire story of this film and really not give away this movie. Let's begin with general thoughts. Bob, what did you think of Upstream Color?
I loved it.
Really?
I could step through the plot and we can even get into, I think, what it's about later on. But I want to actually kind of talk a bit about a review that Roger Ebert did, since, again, we talked about him last time. I'm just going to, a little bit of a tangential thing here. He did a review a number of years ago about a movie called Stormy Monday.
Okay.
And recently, Matt Solar-Seitz and Kim Morgan put together a little video of it where Kim Morgan narrates using his review and Roger Ebert's review, and they put together clips from the movie. And basically says the same thing. I can tell you what this movie is about. But what this movie is about, and he goes into all sorts of little specific details. It's about smoke rings. It's about the way a woman looks at a man before she kisses him. It's about fog and shadows. And he goes on like this. That's kind of what I feel this movie is about. This movie is tactile. I could almost feel this movie. I was immersed in this movie. It enveloped me. It's about sounds and smells and senses and shallow focus. That, to me, is why I love this movie. I mean, there's more to it than that. I mean, the title really comes in at the end about how it's, I think, kind of fighting against man, you know, encroaching on nature and then sort of bringing it back and preventing, you know, some of the encroachment. There's a lot of that, and I like the way he works those themes in. I didn't get a lot of the points of the movie, too. There are some scenes, you know, with the couple, the redheaded woman, that I'm not quite sure. I have sort of a vague understanding of that, but it's just the whole sensory experience of this movie that I was just overjoyed with.
I really dug this. I did not know what to expect. I hadn't seen a movie by Shane Carruth, so I really didn't know what I was getting into. All I had heard was a word coming back from places like Sundance was that this is a somewhat divisive film, that it was a tricky film, that it was a confusing film, and I really did not know what I was getting into. I was just like, well, I'm going. It looks kind of cool, and I've heard a lot of people say good things about Carruth, and it's a very different film. It's not the kind of thing, like we were talking earlier about Sick Day movies. It's not the kind of thing I'm just going to put on when I've got a fever. And
although it's a fever dream
movie. Oh, boy, baby.
Pretty interesting.
Yeah. It would be something I would put on if I was doing things about the apartment and I wanted something pretty on the screen, you know, or something interesting to listen to. In that respect, that it's almost like a concert. It's almost like a jazz performance where there are so many things going on that the story almost does not matter. It is cinematic jazz or cinematic classical music where it's just a feast for the senses.
Yeah, and I don't want to, you know, let go of the story, put little quotation marks around that, because I think it's very relevant. But you can absolutely look at that film this way. And that's why I say it really pulled me in. I don't know if I'd be able to put it on the background, because I'd turn and I'd look and there would be that sort of slow zoom into something, and then it would have the shallow focus, and I get sucked right in again.
And you'd be just burning the toast and
absolutely
ignoring the children.
And all the sound that
ignore
comes
the children
in. Oh yeah, I do have a job. The deep, rich sound of this movie, you know, it's the deep, booming, you know, resonant tones when he's got the speakers pointed down on the earth trying to bring up the worms. The little pieces just in the background, the sound recording, it's fantastic.
The thing I kept hearing from people was, like I said before, how confusing it was. Did you follow everything?
Well, I'm certain there were certainly times I didn't know what was going on, absolutely, but for the most part, I had confidence in the director that not necessarily that it would all tie up nicely at the end with a little ribbon, but that it was going to take me somewhere. And it did. I was able to, if not catch up with it, at least go along with it and say, all right, I'm not quite sure what that scene meant,
right,
but I can file that away and I can start putting it into context with the movie. And I mostly did that. I'm sure I've got my own interpretation. It may not be anywhere near what he was expecting, but that was fine with me. There wasn't any point where I just went, he's got me lost here. let me see. What happened? That didn't happen. I didn't worry about that.
It's funny because for me, there were moments where I was a little lost. Just kind of like you mentioned, there was things where I wasn't quite understanding what exactly was going on, especially in the early going, because it really drops you in the deep end.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to put it mildly. But I just thought, I'm just going to go with it. I kind of compare it to, there are TV shows I watch like The Wire, sometimes Game of Thrones, where I'm not 100% certain of what's happening. Just because there's so many pieces on the board or things are being spoken about in abstract ways. But it's not so bad that I'm like, I'm confused. I'm going away. You know, and I think that's one of the things I like about this film is that it trusts its audience.
That's exactly right.
It sits down and it says, all right, just come along. You might get it. You might not. I promise you won't be bored. But just come along. And that was the thing for me, is that even though I wasn't quite following everything, as I said, especially in the early going, where we're talking about worms and drugs.
The maggots.
And how they relate to the pigs. There were some handsome things about pigs in this movie, in case you didn't know already, folks.
Piglets. Are the cutest thing ever.
They taste delicious. Yes, they do. And the thing that I did like, that actually I did catch from the story, was the idea of two damaged people coming together. Now, in the real world, I usually say that damaged people coming together is a bad idea. You know, like there's enabling that goes on, and there's things that you think that they're not going to be able to grow or not be able to actually get any kind of traction in life. But in fiction, it's wonderful to watch because there's this weird bond that happens between these, you know, really, really screwed up people. And that's what we get with Chris and Jeff. We don't know at the time why Jeff is screwed up. We don't even know that he is, actually, because he hides it at first. We certainly know that Chris is screwed up because we see her before and we see what she's turned into. It almost looked to me, I don't know if you noticed this or not, but it almost looked like they kind of haggard her a little bit. Like she looked a lot healthier in that opening than she did the entire rest of the way. Like she looked like about 20 pounds lighter.
And I think a lot of that was, you know, closing in on her a little bit and the shallow focus and the shorter hair and the clothing. But you're right. I think they did make her look like beaten down.
Yeah, I think there's some makeup going on and certainly some lighting going on. But you kind of, you know, you watch them and you watch how they interact and they're, you know, they don't completely have it together. There's some weird arguments that happen. And it's fascinating because in real life, as I said, I would, you know, if these were friends of mine, I would say, you two should not be together. In this fictional world, hey, go crazy. And, you know, it all kind of culminates in that poster image we see of them, like, taking shelter in the bathtub what we don't even really know. But it's just this moment that they feel threatened and you know, they've got each other.
Yeah, I mean, their meeting is almost like fate in some ways. I mean, you get a brief sort of memory of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, just the way they meet on the train, like they're destined. And in some ways, not giving too much away, they kind of sort of are. But you're right, I mean, it's two very broken, damaged people coming together. And, well, you know, they make their way, but it's funny how their stories, they start kind of almost sharing the same stories. They're sharing almost memories about different things. And it all ties back to a pig farmer.
I don't know about you, but I like this. I know very few films like this. And that's one of the things I love about it, is that it is a very, very original piece of work, very original experience watching it. And speaking of that experience...
You felt very rested afterwards,
well,
I understand.
Wait, here's the thing. The night before I went to see Upstream Color, I got no sleep. Okay, and I mean like not a minute. It was one of those nights where I laid in bed and I was watching TV and I just watched the hours tick over, the minutes tick over, and the minutes tick over, and somewhere around 3:30, I felt it and I was like, this is just not coming. And when that happens, I don't know about you, but I just get up. You know, I'm like,
3:30. I have done that before. Yeah.
3:30. I get out of bed at 6:30. 3 hours is useless to me. There's no point in getting 3 hours. I'm just going to get up and just go through it. And the next day, I know I'll get through the day, but around the end of the workday, I'm just going to be ruined, right? And I'm just going to need to come home and go to bed. But for some reason, I felt I want to see Upstream Color tonight. So I actually put it out to Twitter. And I said to my Twitter followers, I'm going on no sleep. Should I go see Upstream Color? And one or two people said, this is a bad idea. Sure enough, I did end up nodding off for a few minutes in the movie. I'm going to guesstimate it, because I did look at my watch a few times. I'm going to guesstimate it that I missed about 10 minutes of plot. Which, as we've said, in this film really doesn't matter. It kind of...
You probably caught up to speed pretty quick.
Yeah. Well, I asked my friend Corey Attad what I missed. And I did miss something kind of key, but it was something that he could just explain in 1 second. And when I said, well, how did they know that? He goes, I have no idea. So even though I missed it, I didn't
just,
really
miss just
it.
Roll with it, man. Just roll.
But one of the responses I got on Twitter was from Patrick Gamble, a British film writer who writes for a site called Cinema View. And he said to do it, to go on no sleep, because it would be like being stuck in a perpetual state of awakening from the greatest dream you have ever had. And
it's a great way of looking at it.
He is right. That is exactly what this film is like. And I jumped all over it in my review. So thank you for that, Patrick. This film, to me, felt like that moment when you wake up, when you've been dreaming and you first wake up and you're unaware of what you were just thinking and where you are, especially if you're, you know, I'm going to take it one step further and say if you're sleeping and not in your own bed, and you just got this moment, the briefest of moments, it lasts like half a second of what is real, what is not, and you've got what you think are memories, but it was actually dreams, and that's what this whole movie is about. So the fact that I kind of fell asleep in the middle just heightened it that much more.
I've had those kind of film experiences, and it's funny how it's kind of like, you know, it made it so much better. And I went into this movie same way, not quite the same way, but I was really, really tired. I think I even went to Twitter too, and I'm about to see this great action movie. Oh, wait, it's not? Oh, crap. But
and then you guys made fun of me for half an hour.
Yeah. But for me, I was absolutely engaged in this movie. I mean, I totally understand, you know, what you went through, but and maybe part of it was because of that lack of sleep, where it just grabbed a little piece of my brain and hung on, and I just went with it. But I was absolutely engaged for all, 96 minutes of the film.
Yeah. Well, we both love this movie to death, we could be talking about it till rapture, but the thing is, I do want people to see it, and I want people to see it kind of clear of thought, so we're not going to talk too much more about it. I do want to know, though, if you could take a souvenir from Upstream Color, what would you take? What's your souvenir from Upstream Color?
Well, my first thought was that piglets are really, really cute.
And tasty.
but it is that that tactile sense of this movie, of just feeling this movie for the entire run of it, and being enveloped by it, and I love that sensation.
Okay.
I totally do get why some people don't like this movie.
Oh yeah.
Why? Oh, it's too much style, and it's an easy concept, and there's no emotion in it. I've heard that a few times.
Really? I disagree with that.
I sort of get that because the performances are fairly flat. But that makes sense for these characters because they are broken and damaged and they don't have a lot of, you know, ups and downs. They're just, you know, she's on medication. That they're just kind of this flat thing. I think that works perfect for this movie. I did actually feel some emotion myself, but I get why somebody might not feel that. But with all the sensory experience, that's just, you know, that's gravy on top.
Yeah. For me, the souvenir is kind of something that wasn't happening on the screen. It's something that it's a circumstance that I kind of wish we had more of. And it's Carruth's amount of director control. Because he knew that this wasn't going to be like a commercial film, because he knew that this was going to be the kind of thing that played in art house theaters and went to like on demand and that kind of thing, he didn't even try to get a studio like Sony Classics or Fox Searchlight or any of those on board. He figured out a deal where he would be able to distribute it and whatnot himself and get a small release and try and get some money back. And what that gave him was a large measure of control. So what that meant, and this is what I love about it, is that cryptic trailer, that's because he got to cut it himself. That beautiful poster, that doesn't even spell out Upstream Color.
I don't think there's a title screen in this movie.
He got to... It's at the end.
Is it at the end? It's a title card at the end.
Okay. He got to do that himself. He had complete control over this film and how it was sold. And I know that, of course, that, you know, movies are corporate now and big studios and a lot of money, and that, you know, so few directors have this kind of control anymore for reasons that we could be here for a while. But it's wonderful every once in a while to go back to something and see what happens when a director has complete control. So that, for me, is a souvenir. Well, we rate... I can probably guess this at this point. We rate on a scale of 1 to 4 stars. So, Bob Turnbull, what do you give Upstream Color?
I never rate except when I'm on your damn show.
4 times now.
I give it 4. I mean, yeah, you could get picky. If I go back and see it, maybe I'll pick up things and, oh, that doesn't make sense. I expect that I'll pick up more things because I've read a few theories about what it is and I want to, you know, see that again. Just the entire experience of it for me was absolutely 4. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I go to film, to see something different, to experience something a little bit from a different point of view. And boy, does this provide that in so many ways.
For sure. For me, it is a 3.5, only because it was missing for me the real emotional attachment.
Minutes?
No, it wasn't missing. Somebody asked me, Rachel West actually asked me, she said, if you hadn't fallen asleep, would it have gotten up to a 4? And I said, no, because from what I gather, that, I'll tell you what, I will see it again. And if that is true, and I do want to, just because it was awesome anyway. And I will recant, if that it does make the difference, if that is the Rosebud moment, spoilers for Citizen Kane, if that is the Rosebud moment, I will recant and say, that minute that I nodded off just makes complete sense all of a sudden. I will recant. No, but it just, what I was saying is, it just, it missed that little emotional lift that it didn't draw me in just that little bit more, that you know, the 4-star movies that I talk about through the course of the year,
yep.
The ones, you know, that's the only little difference.
Again, I totally get that, because it wasn't as much driven by the characters.
As yeah.
Interesting and damaged and broken as they were, I didn't get that, I'm so empathetic, you know, with them.
Yeah.
I feel them.
So, there we go. That is Upstream Color. Obviously, neither one of us could recommend it higher. We both recommend you see it. Track it down. It's out there, and it is totally worth seeing. We're going to come right back, turn the record over, and play the other side right after that. We'll do this on mic again. Call it again. Heads or tails?
Heads.
Heads it is. So, Primer is your choice for the other side. We didn't really know who we had 2 movies, and we're like, I don't know. So, Primer is officially now your choice for the other side.
It's the obvious one to pick, really. And I debated, we chatted a bit about it beforehand, as to whether I should pick something different. But I think it's a great companion piece, not only because it's Shane Carruth's other film.
Well, it's also one that you talked about before. You brought this up on the
Source Code episode. Right, we talked about Tantra.
I kind of feel like rewatching Source Code. I might have to do that when we're done here. So it's from 2004. It is, as we said, the other film directed by Shane Carruth. You want to try and summarize the plot in 100 words or less?
It's the cheapest budget time travel film you'll ever see.
There we go. Done. It is the obvious double feature because it makes the Shane Carruth double feature. But, like, can you see a little bit more connected tissue between the two movies now that you've seen them both? You've seen Primer several times.
Yeah, I watched it again this week, I think, for the 6th or 7th
time.
Yeah,
versus I watched it for the first time.
Still picked up things I missed the first number of times. Do I have a handle on it? Not completely.
Really? After 6 times? Like, oh, that was the thing.
Hold on. I mean, specifically, scene to scene, all the details of it, I think if you try and do that, you will get too lost to appreciate the movie in and of itself. So usually when I'm watching, I'll pick up little details here and there, but I kind of let that go. I think you almost have to just kind of say, I'm just going to go with that. The first time they actually go through time travel, there's a point where, you know, they're standing from the side, and then they see themselves walk into a building, and you're going, okay, what time of day is this? And then wait a sec. And you're trying to piece it together. And if you do that too much, you really lose the sense of the film.
Well, because you're not listening, for starters.
Right, right. And you just have to kind of go with it. And I think it is a very good companion piece because of... also from a style point of view, too. I mean, there's some things that he does in Primer that he does again in Upstream Color, like the dialogue not matching with what you see on screen.
Right.
Sort of, you know, from the classic scene in Out of Sight. where it's sort of the same kind of thing that's happening, but it's you don't see their lips moving. They're doing something else to what they're saying. And it's very effective in both cases because of the characters.
That's also... what's the one with Donald Sutherland?
Oh, Don't Look Now.
Don't Look Now. They pulled that trick as well, didn't they?
Yeah.
And that seems true.
Works really well in Primer because of this fractured timeline and their fractured almost kind of psyches at that point. Because as they go through, they're kind of getting scrambled themselves every time they go through this machine and they're not quite sure what it's doing to them. That it really is very effective in kind of, yeah, this is happening, but they're saying this. And is it actually at the same time? And which version of this guy is it? And how many times have they gone through? And just all that kind of builds up. And if you wanted to, you could probably count how many times one of the guys goes through and how many times the other guy goes through. That's really irrelevant. And I think people get caught in that. It's a fun exercise, but you're missing the joy of this film.
Well, it's kind of to steal the line from Looper. We could be here and do time travel diagrams with straws all day if we want.
And since Shane Carruth was an advisor for that film, I bet that's exactly where that came from.
Probably. Because, that was the thing. Even just in preparation for this show, when I called up Primer on... Oh, actually, I can show you. You probably have seen this before. But when I called up Primer on Wikipedia, it comes with a diagram of exactly what was happening in this weird little broken infinity. Comes in, there's a loop, and off it goes. It is, you know, it's not the kind of diagram we're used to seeing with time travel. It's not even any kind of a closed...
And I don't even think that's capturing
the time. that's like, you know, the really, really dumbed down version. But that's one of the things I liked about this movie. Seeing it for the first time, I liked that it didn't hold my hand. It's that same thing we talked about with Upstream Color. It's just, you're going to get some of this, you're not going to get all of this, we're going to make it interesting. That's all we promise you. You know, we're not here to spell it out and let you punch holes in our logic. We're here just to tell a story, give you enough physics and rules that this works, and that's it. After that, you're on your own.
Yeah, go with it. Go. This is what happens in this world. Go with that and see where it takes these people and how it breaks them apart, it changes their views on life.
Which is ballsy in an age where we seem to want to nitpick a movie to death. So kind of like thinking about it in the shadow now of Upstream Color, like, was there anything else that kind of jumped out at you?
Well, I think the scene that really grabbed me this time, and it has before, I guess, was when they're filling up the truck at the gas station.
Yeah.
And he's talking about how sometimes when you look back on your life and you wonder where things may have gone wrong, and you start thinking about the rest of the movie and how, yeah, he's got his wife, his child. He's not overly exuberant about that. He's not very happy about having to put his child to bed at night. And he doesn't really spend a lot of time with his wife. His buddy is always there. They're in the garage. He's wondering where his own life went wrong. So to him, this is an opportunity. How do I leave this? How do I break away from this? So he's I think the one line he says is something along the lines of, the worst thing to think of is that this moment you're experiencing right now was already pre-planned, that it was going to happen. But it's interesting that there's another scene where they talk about, you know, him punching, I think, his boss in the face, and they say, once it was spoken, there was no going back.
Right.
And I love that thought of, like, you know what? There is no going back. So he tries to go back and change things, and there are consequences to that.
Yeah.
That scene was a linchpin for me in the movie.
Well, it kind of reminds me of when Kurt was on this show to talk about The Descendants. We talked about Mike Leigh movies and how so many of them come down to the question of, are you happy? And, you know, I've had this conversation with people where you can have a better job. You can be doing what you love. You can be making a whole lot of money. You might think that something you're not currently doing is going to make you happier, but it may very well not, because any little change you make, just like the guys in Primer, any little thing they try and go back to fix comes with its own set of consequences.
Yep.
So yeah, you might get a better job at IBM. You might move up the department. You might have a whole team under you and make a whole lot of money. But that very well may come with more hours, more responsibility, more stress, which means less time with your kid and less time with your wife, less time watching movies, and less time being here talking to me.
Oh, we don't want that.
Will that make you happy?
That would be awful.
Shut up. the one thing that I actually kind of dug about it, it was pointed out during a podcast that I listened to this week about Primer. is the idea of destroying something big to get something small. It's a throwaway piece. Like when they're actually building the device, they've got the fridge. They've got their fridge pulled out, and he's ready to take like the tubing off the back. They're ready to wreck a $600 fridge for $10 worth of tubing. And he goes, "Wait, no! What are you doing?"
He takes the catalytic converter out of one car. He says, "Oh, if we need more, I'll just take it out of my truck."
Yeah. But I love that because I think that that's one of the things the movie. It's just a throwaway line, but I think that we do that an awful lot. We wreck something big in the name of something small. We think, you know, okay, there. Now that's fixed, and we don't realize that, you know, where we just got that little Band-Aid.
There's a cost to it.
Yes. Yeah. No, yeah. I dug that, even though again it just like Upstream Color, and I was awake this time. I didn't quite get everything. Good. So,
and you know, you may very well, you know, watching a second or third time, I got it, and that's fine, and I think I've got it.
Yeah,
and I put that in quotation marks. It's just, you know, a lot of the details. There are moments where I go like, okay, was that the third or fourth time he went? And then I push that away and say, I'm not going to worry about that. But every time I catch more little details and I get more of the mood of it.
Yeah.
And suddenly the title of the film, even primer, like a primer, a coat of paint, and you put other coats on top of that, makes a little bit more sense to me now. And I'm not sure I didn't get that the first time, but now it's like,
I just got to write this minute, actually. So,
and he might, you know, if Shane, if you're listening, you might go, idiot, that's not what it's about.
Yeah.
Fine. But that's kind of what I'm bringing into it.
And I
like movies, getting back to what you were saying before, is movies that you can bring that to. You can bring your own experience or your own ideas to it. And like, hey, I can fit that in.
Yeah. There we go. Well, it was your... according to the loony on the table, it was your choice for The Other Side, so you get the final word. Was there some sort of takeaway or something that just sticks with you with these two films together as a double feature? Or why one complements the other? Or just something from Primer that just has stuck with you over the years? Because it's almost 10 years old now.
That's true, yeah. It was 2004, that's right.
Yeah.
I think I'll just go with my last statement about movies that you can bring in your own experiences and kind of lay them on top, and it kind of fills in those gaps that the movie, I think, purposely kind of leaves there a bit for your own interpretation, for your own, I leave this to you. We've got a pretty good template. We have our own path through it. What's yours?
Very cool. Well, we're going to get to my choice for The Other Side right after this, so come on back, and we'll talk about another film. Well, my, according to the loony on the table, choice for The Other Side, it's from last year. It is a British film or an Italian film?
The director is British,
okay,
I believe.
It's a British film directed by Peter Strickland. It's called The Barbarian Sound Studio. I always want to say Barbarian in
No, I have to think about it before I say it.
It is about the famous Italian movie studio where a lot of great and schlocky movies were made many, many moons ago. And a Foley artist who comes in to complete the film, and it's played by Toby Jones. So the reason why I link them up, and I don't think you quite knew why I had, because I told you...
Not before going in.
I was going to say, I told you this is going to be my choice before you even went to see Upstream Color, is there's this commonality of movies where sound design is key. And in Upstream Color, the sound is subtly bombastic. There are moments, like, you know, we're talking about a movie where the amount of care and design that normally goes into a transformer destroying a car is paid to a dryer door opening. You know, the sounds are heightened, sounds are dropped, sounds are isolated. There's moments where you're watching just like a quiet room and you can hear the ice in the picture, and it almost sounds like glaciers kind of smacking into one another.
Absolutely.
I don't get them. But Lindsay gets a lot of migraines, and she's... I mean, do you?
No, I don't.
Okay. But she's told me that when she gets them, every sound is just amplified to the nth degree. So if I'm in the kitchen rustling a bag of bread, it sounds like I'm shaking tinfoil. And you get that in Upstream Color. You don't get it the same way in Barbarian Sound Studio, because there it's all, of course, done with a purpose. But it's another film where the sound, it's right there in the title, is so key and so well done that I had to think that these two movies would go great together.
It's such a great match. I mean, after I walked out of Upstream Color, I was like, oh yeah, this is perfect. Partially because when I mentioned before that Roger Ebert review of Stormy Monday and the video, the first time I thought about it was before I saw Upstream Color. It was after rewatching Bavarian Sound Studio. I thought of that movie and that review of it because I just seen it recently. And then when I saw Upstream Color, I was like, oh, it fits with this just as well. Because, again, you can go through Bavarian Sound Studio and talk about the plot of this British Foley artist coming and working and helping to dub the sound of an Italian horror movie. I don't want to say horror. It's actually a production by the director. But again, it's not even necessarily about that. It's about dubbing. It's about sound. It's about black leather gloves. It's about analog equipment and dials and switches and screaming.
Easy
it's,
now, it's your about, rush is showing.
Sorry. It's about all those different characteristics of a movie. Like, it's just, again, the sensory, there's very much a sensory overload.
Oh, yeah.
When Toby Jones's character starts going a little off the deep end, and again, it's about, you know, kind of a broken person who really kind of shatters, it's quite amazing, actually.
Yeah. The thing I loved about Barbarian is it's a movie where the central element of the story is very much mirrored in the film itself. So I'll give you a for instance. The one thing that I can't stand, coming from an art studies background, the one thing I can't stand is watching movies about famous artists and having their art play such a small role within the film. So there's been films about artists where we don't even see them hold a brush or make a sculpture. Like, we don't see them at work. On the flip side of things, you'll get a movie like Frida by Julie Taymor, where the art is all, like, it's all around the film. The film, you can't get away from the art as well. So this film, where we're talking about a sound designer, the sound is the film. You could almost watch it with your eyes closed, if that, of course, you know, just wouldn't completely ruin it. But it's so central to this movie that you don't even see the film they're working on. You just get a sense of it from the amount of work they're going
through. That's right. You never actually see it.
Yeah. You see shot lists and designs, and you see, you know, like, you get the idea because they layer it all on top of one another that you can kind of understand the scene. And there's times where that you, like, you see something written and then you see them make the effect. So you see, I think the scene is something like a woman jumps to her death. Like, a woman jumps from the balcony. And you hear the wind, and then you see him shake the tarp, so it's like it's her jacket falling, and then you hear, like, the crunch.
Then you see the vegetables coming to
play. Yes, exactly. He does wonderful work with melons and cabbages. And
celery.
He's using celery for, like, broken bones. The one that gets me, of course, is it's a waste of good melon. So they keep bringing the melon out for them to snack on while they're working. It's such a good movie.
That's true. The scene where the guy offers him to slice a melon after he's been chopping it up into pieces with, we're assuming, bloody carnage on screen. It's just great.
Yeah, melon? Yeah.
And it works, I think, so much better never seeing a clip from the film that it's, you know, that he's doing the Foley for.
Yeah.
Part of me does actually want to see this film. But the one thing I guess you do see is the opening credits for, I think, that film, which are absolutely brilliant. The kind of red and black with the, you know, the music is so much from that 70s era of Italian horror.
Yeah.
Like Suspiria, you know, the music by Goblin.
Right.
And I think they even have a name
for the group. Was it your copy of Suspiria that I borrowed?
I believe it was.
Thank you for that.
No problem. It was like Hypnomoned or something was the name of the group. I don't even know if they're a real group to be honest. It was awesome. It was like, oh, I just want that section, you know, looped over and over.
But it's the same sort of, it's kind of funny because, okay, so I'm going to come back to it because it's been the theme this whole episode. I've watched Barbarian Sound Studio in two sittings. And the reason because I watched it in two sittings was because I kept falling asleep. and not because of boredom, but just because I was just, you know, and it was that same sort of thing of coming in and out of dream state. Really worked for that movie because he's off his rocker for most of it anyway. So I'm watching him work and I'm watching him be twitchy and then I'm watching him work and I'm watching him be twitchy. And as I'm coming in and out, you know, sometimes you're closing your eyes because you're imagining what he's doing anyway. So it was another one of these movies that me not being completely 100% alert actually underlined it and worked rather well.
It is funny you say that. The first time I saw it, I no problems falling asleep. I watched it. I really liked it. I loved it the second time I saw it. And the second time I have to say I nodded off occasionally because I was late in the night. I wanted to cram it in because I knew it was going to be on your show and all that. And I nodded off a couple of times. And for whatever reason, the damn thing just works so much better.
That's what I'm saying, right?
So that's our recommendation.
I'm telling you, exactly. Listen, there was a lot
catch
of
up on your sleep when
there
you
was
the
a
movie.
Lot of artwork created in the 60s and 70s that was told that, you know, it works a whole lot better if you work some hallucinogenics into it. I say work in some sleep, and some of these things will be marvelous. I might just go see To the Wonder again and see what happens when I work in a nap to that.
Sleep through the middle.
The one little takeaway for me with Barbarian Sound Studio is I almost wonder if, and I don't want to sound like, you know, the old guy standing on his porch telling the kids to get off his lawn, but I almost wonder if we're losing the importance of sound. With these two movies, that sound design is so key. I don't think I would have got that same impression if I had to watch them on my laptop or on my phone. My regret with Barbarian Sound Studio is that I didn't see it in the theater.
Yeah, me too.
We didn't get it here. I think it played here a week. Maybe.
Yeah, and it was at TIFF, but yeah, again. It was,
yeah, and that was one of those ones at TIFF that all y'all that got to see it came back just loving, and it was one of those ones that I immediately regretted not working into my schedule. But I wonder...
It was right before our pub night, so come on. It was a tough sell.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I wonder if, you know, in this age where we're talking... Like, you know, I'm a visual guy. I'm a guy who likes to see pretty pictures on a big screen and dial in. But I wonder if we're getting away from the importance of movies that have really good sound. And I'm not just talking about stuff like Skyfall and stuff like Zero Dark Thirty, where it's an action film with really well-designed sound. I'm talking about stuff where the sound design is really subtle.
Yeah, and I could not agree with you more on that point. I mean, as a fan of horror, not just Italian horror, but a whole bunch of it, sound is one of the key components for me of a good horror film, especially one that makes you kind of curl up on your couch without you really knowing it.
Well,
it's subtle things. It's the low sound. It's the cutting out of sound altogether.
Yeah.
Which will just make the pit of your stomach just drop down to your feet.
Well, I was going to say, we've talked before, or more to the point, you've mocked me before for my aversion to The Exorcist, and I've said before, I can watch it, but I can't listen to it.
Exactly. And that's how effective good sound design can be.
Yeah, and I do fear we're losing it, but so movies like Barbarian Sound Studio, I adore because they celebrate sound and you know, the crazy work that goes into it. Well, you know, there's three films that... admittedly, or smaller.
Thank you for inviting me to the show that no one's going to tune in.
I can get you back on the Ginger and Roses show that is very low.
Okay, fair enough.
Exactly, where we talked about Ratcatcher. I cannot wait for summer.
I'd rather talk about this movie.
As would I. Like that. See, that's the thing, is that what I like to do more is I like to talk about these kind of movies and have people add them to their Netflix queue or have people buy them and whatever and give them a go or download them or whatever. Rather than being the 20,000th person talking about The Great Gatsby in 2 weeks, like we're entering summer, and as nice as it's going to be, that's what's going to happen. We're all going to be talking about the same movies, and in large part saying the same things. So I'd rather be talking about Barbarian Sound Studio and Primer and Upstream Color, and maybe just maybe getting somebody to give them a look or tell me
nice.
I'm wrong or that kind of thing. Nice. So that's why I want you here. You know, I want you here for your insight on the good stuff. You know, I got Price talking about Superman. What are we going to say about that?
You know? You know what? If you're going to have somebody talk about Superman,
Price.
He's the guy.
Exactly.
Also, you want me here because I brought a nice beer.
You did. Thank you for that. Exactly. I've got a full fridge now. This is wonderful. That is episode 83 of the Matinee Cast, the Hot Docs Dispatches, Life in Technicolor. We'll start dropping sometime around April 30th. The Matinee Cast proper will return on May 13th. Where we'll be discussing The Great Gatsby. Bob writes on Eternal Sunshine of the Logical Mind.blogspot.com.
A little bit of Row 3 as well.
Yeah. Oh, yes, you write on Row 3 as well. Do you have anything coming up?
Well, Hot Docs, obviously.
Oh, that's right.
And I'm trying to refocus on the blog. I need to get back to more just visual posts of screen caps, shorter posts.
You're doing
just
well.
Be more engaged with it because I really do miss kind of doing that.
I want another montage.
I'll work out. Yeah, but
the gauntlet has been thrown down. Not by me.
Dude. Lindsay is a professional. It's obvious she's a professional. You watch that video, it's like, oh, that's how it's actually done. So so how can
she
I?
She liked your stuff. She always looked at those. She goes, oh, "This
I
is pretty good."
I appreciate that.
You were what inspired her to do those.
Oh well, wow. That's
see.
Thank you. I need to find something that it actually is going to inspire me again. So the first two I did, they came quickly. I'm not sure they're great, but I enjoy doing them. The third one I like doing, but it's like, I forced that one.
It'll
so I need to get that inspiration.
My site, of course, is thematinee.ca. For more podcasting content, you can find them a great number of ways. You can go to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them on Stitcher Radio, the Movie Pods app, which groups me together with shows like Mammo and Film Junk and Row 3 Cinecast and Film Jive and all kinds of other shows that are much better than mine. Blueberry, you can find my show there, and the iTunes stores. They all give you ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop.
Feedback. What, these podcasts are free? My goodness, what value.
What a bargain. Feedback on Upstream Color, Primer, or Barbarian Sound Studio can be left in the comment section of the site. You can email me, ryan@thematinee.ca. You can find me on Facebook, which is facebook.com/darkmatinee, or Twitter, which is matinee_ca.
You're including the outtakes on the show, right?
We'll see. Any final thoughts, sir?
Thanks again for having me. This was great. I enjoyed the discussion. We had a lot more to say about it than I thought.
Well, you provided welcome distraction to this terrible baseball game that's happening over there, even though I've been glancing.
I don't know if
it
was actually engaged in distraction. He was looking over the TV far more than he was looking at the game.
I can multitask, at least.
That is a bit of a
That's what I'm saying. For Bob, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at the matinee. Find me and follow me through corridors, refractories, and files you must follow.